Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, here for a whole hour, not just a half hour, whole hour of weird questions for Jimmy Akin. Jimmy, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, but well known now as the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and has a growing reputation over the years for being willing to answer quite seriously some questions that other people don't have the ability to answer, but also just to have a lot of fun with them. Weird questions, mysterious questions, all that stuff. Jimmy, you
are. Or questions that others wouldn't take seriously, but I try to answer seriously no matter how strange the question is.
Yeah, yeah. And so that developed into this program, Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. And also, has been an important part of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, which you should check out over at mysterious.fm, or just type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. You'll find it. It's patrons' questions this week, and some of them are fantastic. The list that you gave us before, Jimmy, was enticing, to say the least. I mean, they come up with good questions.
It was meant to be.
Yeah, they know how to play the game. They come up with really good – these patrons – they come up with good questions. They're not wasting their shot.
No, and some of them get answers that may be different than what people are expecting.
Like, yeah.
What I have to say about Ouija boards is not what most people would predict. I'm not a fan of Ouija boards, but if you look at the evidence, it does not correspond to a common conception about Ouija boards.
Oh, I would love to hear that. All right, I'll have to tune in for the... And by the way, it's dropped already. You can get it at mysterious.fm right now. But don't get it for at least another hour, because we got Jimmy live with us doing weird questions.
Well, recorded live. Yes, I'm live at the time we're recording this.
Playing out live. That's what I meant. Playing out live. We're not just on podcast yet. Soon to be. Soon to be in the files. So the Ouija board question, all kinds of interesting questions. That's the thing is, I think people, we have these weird questions because we live in a very strange world. We need somewhere to go. Somebody's going to answer them. Take them seriously. Look at the evidence of reason, the evidence of faith, all that. So I think that's why it's so popular. We've solved the lunch meat round bread square conundrum. This next question comes from Zane. Jimmy, he begins. Huge fan of your work, your terminal intellect, and your towering beard. Or maybe I got that backwards. That's funny, Zane.
He's referring to the fact I've grown my beard out to its terminal length. Hair on our bodies grows to a certain length and stops. And different hairs are programmed to grow to different lengths. That's why our eyebrows are the length they are, but hair on our scalp is much shorter than our eyebrows, and why the hair on our bare like forehead, we do have hair there, but it is very short, and then hair on the back of our scalp is much longer, and if you're a man, the hair on your beard can be much longer, and I let mine grow out to its terminal length. So when he refers to my terminal intellect and towering beard, that's what he's referring to.
Is that a spoonerism?
It's a conceptual spoonerism. Oh, yeah. It's not a proper spoonerism. There was a British clergyman named Reverend Spooner, and he was known for accidentally swapping the first morphemes of two words. A morpheme is the sound you make. And so he said, for example, that when he retired, retirement came as a blushing crow instead of a crushing blow.
Oh, that's
and
a good one.
Swapping
though.
Those morphemes came to be known as spoonerisms in his honor. But this is kind of a conceptual spoonerism. What Zane is referring to is me having a terminal beard and a towering intellect, but he's swapped those two terms.
It's funny, Zane. So this is Zane's actual question.
And Si, you're frozen.
But can you hear me, or am I just video frozen? How about audio?
I don't know if you're still getting motion from me, but I'm not showing any CPU load, so...
Oh, no, I see you moving.
The issue is not on my end.
Well, I'll just read the question. You can just cut my video, and I'll just read the question. This question... Okay, so this is Zane's question. If we in the eschaton are given our infallible bodies, and the New Jerusalem in essence becomes our planet Krypton, can you postulate on what we will do in the eschaton? Saints are generals in God's army, but what will our missions be? Will we go and evangelize the universe of fallen creatures? If so, will Christ have to incarnate on that world to save them? Or will we have been made gods? Or is that a blasphemous thing? If we do, hypothetically, have to incarnate for them, would our infallible bodies change to the alien form we incarnate? For thus we become aliens only until we go to the next world. Or, if only Christ can do the incarnating, saving would be, this is a lot of stuff. Are we going to have to, okay. I'm getting cross signals. All right, I'm just going to continue reading it because it goes on and on. So the basic idea is, although I'm sure Jimmy will have to help with the terminology of infallible bodies a little bit. So after we're dead, we rise, we are in our glorified bodies. What do we do? And one of the possibilities is we go to the rest of the universe to evangelize the rest of the universe, and we might incarnate. We might incarnate then as aliens. So the last part of the question then, or if only Christ can do the incarnating, saving would be, or are there already millions of incarnations of Christ and his form in heaven adjusted to whatever creature he is interacting with? That is a long and complex set of questions, but I leave it to you, Jimmy.
So we don't know what our missions in the afterlife are going to be. We're told that we will reign with Christ, but we don't know exactly what that's going to involve. We certainly don't know if our missions are going to be extraterrestrial in nature. They may just involve living eternal life and running the new earth. If we evangelize others, then, you know, if we go to other planets to do evangelization, then we might or might not appear in their forms. You know, we have some evidence that Jesus is, in his glorified state, is able to change his form. And we, you know, the evidence for that consists of when, for example, when he appears to the two disciples on the road to Emmaus and they don't recognize him. Now, personally, I don't think that the best understanding of that is he was in a different form, because it doesn't say he changed shape and then they recognized him. It just says they recognized him. And that suggests to me a different phenomenon, which is known as prosopagnosia. Prosopon is the Greek word for face, and gnosis is the word for knowledge. So prosopagnosia is not knowing a person's face. In agnosia means not. So prosopagnosia means not knowing people's faces. And it's a real condition. It's also called face blindness, and it is a neurological issue that some people have where they can see you perfectly well, but their brain is just not associating your face with your identity. And it looks to me like what happened with the two disciples on the road to Emmaus is they had temporary induced prosopagnosia. And then when Jesus broke the bread, that condition was withdrawn and they were able to recognize him. But, you know, he's also God, and God can do anything logically possible. So I think it's possible for Jesus to appear in other forms to change shape, or at least create the impression that he's in a different form. And we're told that we're going to be like Jesus, not in every respect, but in many respects. So I think that we might be able to appear in other forms to alien beings. There's even evidence that in the afterlife, in the intermediate state, the human soul can appear in different forms. It can project different mental images to living people of what it looks like. And so that's why, for example, when you have an apparition of a saint or a ghost, the saint or the ghost can change its appearance. You know, for example, dressing in old-fashioned clothing versus newer clothing or something like that. It's also possible that Christ might or might not incarnate as one of their species. We talked about how last hour omnipotence allows God to assume an additional nature, like he's assumed human nature. Well, if Klingons were real, he could also assume a Klingon nature and redeem Klingons as a Klingon. But he may not do it that way. Aquinas talks about how God could have redeemed us in any number of different ways. He chose to use Christ's death in human form on earth to redeem us, but he might redeem aliens in some other way. Or he might not. He might choose to redeem them through an incarnation of Christ in their species, or he might choose to redeem them through Christ's incarnation as a human. In which case, the infinite effects of his death might be applied to them as well for redemption. If there are other incarnations of Christ, then some of them may have already ascended to heaven, and so I don't see any reason that divine omnipotence couldn't have multiple incarnations of Christ in heaven at the same time, if that's what God chose. What I don't know is what choices God has made.
That was a long, complex question, Zane. I hope you were satisfied with the answer. I appreciate the question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today. Well, it's time for the break, so we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Weird Questions for Jimmy right after this.
Your questions, Catholic answers, live.
Experience the incredible story of the woman who Time magazine named the most influential Catholic woman in the United States. Born Rita Rizzo, the future mother Angelica grew up in a rough neighborhood in Canton, Ohio. Young Rita experienced abandonment, rejection, and heartache, but God touched her through a woman named Rhoda Wise. Encounter this amazing woman at the Mother Angelica Museum. Plan your visit today at motherangelicamuseum.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Hi, this is H. McKay. Join me for our weekly look at some of the best Catholic webcasts from across America. Catholics Coast to Coast, your chance to get a sample of some of the great podcasts we have available at EWTNradio.net. And to encourage you in your walk with God and your Catholic faith, log in to EWTNradio.net, and at Podcast Central is where you can find great shows. Catholics Coast to Coast, Sunday night, 6 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it's Weird Questions for Jimmy Akin. We got a whole bunch of weird questions for Jimmy. People think of the wildest things, many of them I never would have thought of, and I personally find that a lot of fun to get to hear these wild questions. Here's a good one from Chris. Chris wants to know, Jimmy, why did humans take so long to be advanced just recently with agriculture, medicine, economy, infrastructure? What were we doing for 200,000 years?
Well, we were trying to survive, and that wasn't easy when you're not in a developed civilization. You're in a small tribal group, and you don't have advanced technology, you don't have advanced medicine, you don't have advanced food production. All of those things began to happen after in the Neolithic age with the agricultural revolution. And that introduced a lot more specialization of labor into human communities where before maybe you had a leader and a priest or shaman in your tribe, and they had some specialized labor, but most people, they all had the same job, being a hunter-gatherer. Might be a different set of duties for a man than for a woman, but basically there's one career path open to almost everybody. And so you couldn't go to a specialist to deal with a lot of things. You didn't have specialist teachers to teach your children for you. You didn't have specialist auto mechanics because you didn't have automobiles. And so everybody had the basic knowledge they needed to do their job, and not much more. And so they also didn't have any way of passing on information except orally, person to person. So if you're going to train somebody in here's how you be a hunter-gatherer, you know, you could train your kids in how to do that, but it's not like you could write it down. And so if you had some extra knowledge besides just how to be a hunter-gatherer, you didn't have any way to pass it on except orally. So there's a very low bandwidth of communication. After the invention of writing, which only occurred about 5,000 years ago, you could write down information and it could live on after you. And that information could go and spread more widely. But until you had writing, you couldn't do that. All learning required person-to-person contact. And given the difficulties of survival, that and the difficulties of communicating and building storehouses of knowledge, those are key reasons why humanity's development was so slow in the beginning, because life was so tough just to survive, and there was no easy way to pass on information except by conversation one-to-one. There's also another possible factor, which is as human societies have grown more complex, and there may be different reasons for this, but as human societies have grown more complex, our intellects have needed to also become more complex to deal with the greater social complexity. And so there is evidence that human intelligence has been rising over the last few thousand years. And it's quite possible that there may have been some notable upgrades in human intelligence within the last few tens of thousands of years. And they continue today. We're undoubtedly or very likely to be smarter than our ancestors 4,000 years ago were. Now, that would also be another reason why progress was so slow in the beginning if humans weren't as smart as they are now. So as the complexity of society increases, the human intellect also increases, and that accelerates the rate of change and the rate of technological advancement. So you have kind of a feedback loop, a virtuous circle that drives us towards accelerating improvements compared to what was happening in 100,000 years ago.
Chris, that was a fantastic question. Thank you very much for that weird question. Maybe the best name of the hour, Molecat, asks this, or maybe Molecat. With admission by the USA of UFOs, what do we think about extraterrestrial beings, souls, evangelizing, origins, etc.? First of all, Molecat, you should watch a show called Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Well, and specifically, they should listen to episode 55, which is where I go into all those questions. The answer is the church doesn't have teachings on these questions. It's open to the existence of extraterrestrial life. And if there are intelligent aliens, then they would have rational souls the same way we do. They might or might not be fallen. If they might or might not need evangelization, they would be God's other children. They would just be additional people he made elsewhere. But we don't know anything about them, or even if they exist. So there are a lot of possibilities about, you know, do they need evangelization? Can you baptize them? Which sacraments can you give them? Like, and it can depend on their biology. You know, I mean, let's suppose they have three sexes instead of two, and you need all three sexes to breed. They might have three-person marriages. Or let's suppose they're monosexual and a single organism in their species can reproduce by mitosis. You know, it can just kind of split itself in two and then regrow from there. Well, that species might not have marriage at all. And so there are a lot of possibilities. And if you want to hear an exploration of them, check out episode 55 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. You can get to it by going to mysterious.fm/55.
And thank you very much for that question. Appreciate it, Molecat. No asks
Noah.
Thinking, oh, that's Noah? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. I think about the doctrine of divine simplicity and the afterlife. If God is not made of any parts, what are we going to see when in heaven? Or what is he going to reveal to us if he is so simple?
Okay, so we often talk about heaven as involving the beatific vision of God. Beatific means happy. So we're going to have a happy vision of God. At least that's how heaven is pictured. But what kind of vision are we talking about? Well, God doesn't have a physical body apart from the incarnation. So there's nothing there physically to see. So when theologians talk about the beatific vision, what they are imagining is not literal physical vision where photons come into your eyes and get translated by your retina and nerve system in your brain. It's not physical vision, it's spiritual insight. So this is an intellectual vision where you perceive God's nature. And it may or may not involve picturing something. It may be a pure spiritual insight that does not involve any imagery. You just have an intense understanding of God and his perfection. On the other hand, though, it is possible that there might be imagery associated with this, in which case it would be whatever, we'd see whatever God wants us to see. God has used visions in which he appeared to have human form, and that means parts, so a hand and a face and things like that. For example, in the book of Daniel, you know, Daniel sees the Ancient of Days. He sees God seated on a throne in heaven, and, you know, he would have seen him as a majestic king, and so it's possible that we might see, presumably with white hair, since he's described as the Ancient of Days. So he presumably, it's suggesting he's very old, and so that would be presumably represented by white hair and a white beard. And that's the image that God chose to give Daniel to enable Daniel to visualize him. And God could do something similar with us, but he doesn't literally have parts because he doesn't literally have a physical body apart from the incarnation. And what we would see might involve parts, but it would just be a representation to help facilitate our interaction with God.
Thanks very much for that question, Noah. Appreciate it. I think I got time. I'm just checking the clock here. I'm going to do Susanna's question. We'll see. I think we can get through it. I heard that Lucifer's rebellion was that God revealed the incarnation of the Son, for which he refused to serve a man. Does that mean it wasn't revealed that God is Trinitarian? I'm assuming that because God is omnipresent, the Son is God and is man.
Well, it's true that the Son is both God and man. It's not because God is omnipresent. It's because the Son chose to incarnate as a man. If it was because of omnipresence, then we would all be Jesus because he's everywhere. And it's not the case. Not every human being is Jesus. There is a unique relationship between Jesus's divinity and Jesus's humanity as opposed to your or my humanity. So it's the incarnation as a human, not omnipresence, that makes Jesus both God and man. The Trinitarian nature of God was presumably revealed to those in heaven. So presumably the angels, including the devil, knew about it. According to the story that you sometimes hear, and this is only one story, but according to the story you sometimes hear, the devil refused to serve because Jesus would add a human nature to his divine nature. And the devil, in his pride, regarded that as human nature as too lowly. And so he didn't want to give worship to Jesus through this lowly human nature. But I have to say, we're not told why the devil fell. Mm-hmm. It does not say that anywhere in Scripture. There have been different speculations about why the devil fell, but they are all just speculations. And so I wouldn't take any of them as the definitive truth.
That's a very fine question, Susanna. Appreciate that. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. We got just a second before we'll take a quick break, then we'll come back with lots more questions for you. I wanted to invite you to our National Apologetics Conference. This year's topic is I Believe in God. It runs from September 21st to 24th right here in San Diego. And you can find out all about it at CatholicAnswersConference.com. We've got a great price for you. And we have wonderful guests. Dr. Scott Hahn is going to be there. Sister Regina Marie Gorman is going to be our keynote speaker. Jimmy will be there, as with all of our apologists. We'll do the radio show. It's just a lot of fun. Very educational opportunity. And this time, a chance to meditate on God and get better at explaining God to a world that's less and less interested in God. CatholicAnswersConference.com. This year, the Catholic Answers Conference turns its attention to the question of God in an age of unbelief. Join us September 21st through 24th in San Diego for I Believe in God, featuring very special guest Scott Hahn and an all-star lineup of speakers. Spend four fun days with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. Seats are still available, but going fast. Use promo code EARLY to save $50 and register today at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Always just a great way to spend a Friday afternoon. I think we mostly do it on Fridays. Maybe we have done it a different day a few times, but mostly we've done it on Fridays. And Nicole is in the spirit. As a matter of fact, I really appreciate this question because it may not be one that's top of mind, but when I read it, I thought, I want to know the answer to that. Nicole asks, what are your thoughts on spontaneous human combustion? Is there evidence it's happened, or what would be a possible explanation for it?
So spontaneous human combustion is a phenomenon that's been reported, and there are cases where someone mysteriously caught fire and burned up. Typically, they were alone, and when people found their remains, it would, you know, they would be charred, and oddly, you know, the furniture, none of the furniture around them may have been burned up. It didn't like burn up the entire room, just the person. And some of their body parts might still be there and not burned, like their feet or something would be left over and not be burned. So it's a mysterious phenomenon. The question is, what causes it? And I think that we have a good explanation for at least most of the cases of spontaneous human combustion. First of all, there are a set of factors that tend to characterize the majority of the cases. The majority of the cases will tend to have three prominent factors, and there will usually be at least two of them in a given case. One of the factors is old age. A lot of the people this happens to are old. Another is alcohol consumption. A lot of the people this has happened to had been consuming alcohol. And a third thing that it applies to many of these cases is smoking. They also were smokers. And you put those together and, okay, so if you're elderly, you may have mobility issues. You may not be able to just get up and run away and so forth. If you have an accident while smoking. Similarly, if you've been drinking alcohol, you may be out of it. You may not be aware when you have an accident smoking, and you may not be conscious, or you may just be on the edge of consciousness when it happens. And it could be that you've been drinking, you go unconscious first, and then you drop your cigarette or your cigar or your pipe, and your clothing catches fire, and you're out of it. You're unconscious, so you don't run away. And then what happens is, I hate to put it this way, but then you become a human candle. If you think about how candles work, they have a wick, which is the thing that burns, and the wick is driven by the wax in the candle. And wax is a kind of fat. Essentially, wax is a fat that's fully solid at room temperature. And so that feeds into the wick and burns. And eventually, and because of how candles work, if you think about it, you light a candle, it's going to consume the wax, but it's not going to catch the whole room on fire. It's just the candle itself will burn, but not everything around it. Oh. And so you essentially become a human candle, whether you're disabled through old age and or alcohol, and then you have a smoking accident, and your clothing becomes the wick, and your body fat becomes the wax, the fuel for the fire. And over a period of hours, just like a candle can burn for hours, you burn like a candle without catching the entire room on fire. And maybe little lower parts of you, like your feet, get left. But that seems to explain the majority of cases of so-called spontaneous human combustion. It only appears spontaneous because of nobody's there to see it start, you know, because the person who is there dies. But that seems to explain most of these cases. Having said that, there are also reports of some cases where an obscure chemical process or metabolic process within the human body heats a person up unreasonably and might even lead to spontaneous human combustion. So it could be related to obscure chemical processes in the body in some cases, but that has yet to be scientifically confirmed. So I think the old age smoking alcohol trio is responsible for most cases, but there may be some cases with unusual metabolic processes involved as well. If you'd like to hear more about all that, check out episode 149 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on spontaneous human combustion by going to mysterious.fm/149.
Nicole, thank you very much for that question. What show would be complete without a spontaneous human combustion question? It's weird questions for Jimmy Akin this hour. This one comes from Steve. What's the evidence that humans matured earlier in life in Christ's time?
Well, like, it's going to depend on what you mean by matured. You know, are we talking about social maturity or biological maturity? It may be the case that we mature biologically more quickly today, and that would be due to better diet and nutrition. On the other hand, people in the past did mature more socially more quickly than we do today. The modern institution of being a teenager, where you're kind of in this in-between time for a number of years between childhood and adulthood, that is a new thing. People in the past were either children or adults, and they didn't have this lengthy quasi-adult period where they didn't have the responsibilities or options of adults. And so as to why people would mature socially more quickly in the past, I would say it was a combination of reasons. One of them is life was much harder. So people needed to go to work and do stuff at earlier ages, and that accepting of responsibility, you know, having responsibility thrust on them sooner, made them grow up faster. We didn't have this long period where they could just laze around their parents' house, not really contributing. And being irresponsible and playing video games instead of going to work. And also getting education, but you didn't need as much education back then to have a job. So you could end up being functionally an adult at an earlier age. Your parents weren't going to let you lay around the house playing video games because video games didn't exist, but they weren't going to let you lay around the house playing card games because people did have games in the past. And you were expected to go to work and assume responsibility and get out of your parents' house and become an adult, or not get out of your parents' house and become an adult in cultures where they had extended families. But one way or another, you were expected to assume more responsibility earlier in life than you are now.
Thanks very much, Steve. Appreciate that question. I think that brings us right about to the break. So we'll take this break and we'll be right back with more Weird Questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
I really can't get enough Catholic teaching now that I'm back. I've been back about 8-9 years. It was due in part to Catholic radio, television, and learned so much.
I get most of my news from EWTN. EWTN is just wonderful. I especially love the Sunday Masses.
Both you guys were a magnificent resource in my journey to come into full communion with the Catholic Church, and thank you very much for being there.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Weird questions for Jimmy Akin. You know, when you get a question about spontaneous human combustion, or a question about Lucifer's rebellion, or when those questions just come one after the other, then you know you're listening to Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Or you're listening to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, the edition that the patrons get to ask their questions, which is what's available today at mysterious.fm. All right, more of these weird questions for you, Jimmy. Oh, I like this one, Marianne. Thank you. This is grounded in a possible short-term future here, the near-term future for humanity. Marianne wants to know, what would be the moral implications of joining an expedition to colonize Mars or other planets, knowing that there would be no access to any sacraments indefinitely?
Well, we can look to the past for information about this question, because this has happened before in the age of sail. When people were crossing oceans to colonize new lands, we can look at what they did. And there have been cases, even before the age of exploration in the age of sail, where people would go on business journeys that could last years, or military expeditions that could last years, and they might be deprived of the sacraments for a long time. And the church did not prohibit these things. So, we do have an obligation to receive communion once a year, and we have a communion responsibility typically at Easter time, and we have a responsibility to confess our mortal sins once a year, but we're excused from that if it's physically impossible. So if there's no priest around, you can wait longer to do it. And there have been people who went on trips, whether commercial or military or what have you, that would deprive them of the sacraments for lengthy periods. And the church didn't say you can't undertake such trips.
Yeah.
So what happens if you do? Well, you, if you commit mortal sins, then you need to be careful, and you want to make acts of perfect contrition to reconcile with God before you're able to restore connection with the sacrament of penance. You then will ultimately want to confess, you know, what you did, but it can wait until you have access to a priest. But you can be reconciled with God even before you're able to go to confession by an act of perfect contrition. So you'd want to do those. You also probably would not want to just head out, if it's a colony, without any priests. You know, you'd want to take priests with you. That's what people in the Age of Exploration did. When they'd found a colony somewhere, they'd bring priests along with them. And I would expect that early on, I mean, maybe not on the first colonization flight to Mars, but very early on, you would have Catholic priests who would volunteer to go to Mars and be dispatched by their bishops as, you know, missionary priests on Mars to minister to the Martian colonists.
I hope that that's the case. The church usually is pretty proactive in thinking about these things. I hope somebody's mm-hmm. thinking about priests. I've got some priests I'd like to send. No, that's not that's not the right spirit. But yeah.
Well, I mean, for example, on cruise ships.
Yeah,
it is very common to have priests on cruise ships to minister to the Catholics who are on board the cruise ship. And if you're taking a whole bunch of people to Mars, you would expect as long as there are some Catholics there, you would expect priests to go along too.
Yeah. One ministry that I've always loved that we have as Catholics is we have priests who are for people who work in circuses and carnivals. That their ministry is to the people who work in circuses, and then they'll travel with them. I think that's important stuff. So, Marianne, good job.
I want to see a fire eating priest.
I know. Like, I want what's to see his a priest. Day job when he's out there with the carnival?
Yeah, I want to see a priest do the human volcano.
All right, this one comes from Mark. Mark asks, if Christ made a visit to all continents together with Joseph, Mary, and the apostles, just like a papal visit, before he was crucified, would the world have become Christian?
Well, it depends on what Jesus does when he goes to a place. And there actually are claims that Jesus did go to other places. Now, you'll find some New Agers who say that Jesus went to India when he was young. There's no evidence for that. And really, there's no good evidence for any of these claims. But you do have claims. Mormons, for example, claim that after the crucifixion, Jesus came to the New World and evangelized Native Americans and people who were in America. And they started a church, and it lasted for a few centuries. You'll also find some people in Britain who would claim that either before or immediately after his ministry, Jesus came to England and came to the island of Great Britain. And they'll say it was connected with the tin mining industry, and that Joseph of Arimathea was in the tin mining industry and would go to Britain for commerce, and he would bring the boy Jesus and or the Virgin Mary along with him. And there's even a famous British song called England's Mountains Green, which has a lyric that says, "And did those feet in ancient times walk upon England's mountains green?" Well, the feet they're talking about are Jesus's feet. No. And so you have these British claims as well. Now, there isn't good evidence for claims that Jesus lived anywhere other than Israel and Egypt. and Egypt only briefly when he was a toddler. But it's going to depend on what happens there. In the Mormon account, he did found a church, but it didn't last. In other accounts, like the British account, and the Indian account, he didn't found a church there. So if he went someplace, even taking Joseph, Mary, and the apostles with him, they evangelized and founded a church. Well, they, depending on how long they stayed there, the church might become established and might last for some period of time and might even last to the present day. But that's not the timeline that we live in, where he didn't make a world tour of all the continents and set up churches everywhere. Instead, he made a tour of Israel. And actually, I guess now that I think about it, he also got up into Syria, like when he met the Syrophoenician woman, and went to Tyre and Sidon. But he stayed in that little area of Israel and the surrounding territories. And then he let the 12 apostles go elsewhere and found churches. But he didn't have a first century worldwide evangelistic campaign. If he did, it might have had the success it has would depend on the two factors of how much grace God gave and how humans responded to that grace.
Mark, thank you very much for that question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. A whole bunch more to go. So on we go with Seth's question. Did Jesus have opinions, such as having a favorite food or favorite color? Would these be the results of random biology and environment as he grew up?
So I think the answer is presumably yes. Jesus did have opinions of, like, I prefer this to that. I think that would definitely be, I'm not sure that that would be the case with favorite color, because not everybody has a favorite color. I don't really have a favorite color. When I was a boy, my favorite color was green, but I think I picked it because I thought it was cool and because everybody had a favorite color at that age. But as an adult, I don't really think of having a favorite color. I do have foods I prefer, and which foods I prefer is a combination of at least two factors. One is habituation, what is available in your environment. This came home to me in a notable way some years ago when I was over at the house of a friend whose family was vegetarian. And so I'm there, my friend is there, his wife is there, they've made a vegetarian meal, and they have two daughters who are like 1 and 2 years old, you know, or 1 and 3 years old. They're very small children. And I see these, and they've got this big salad for us to eat as one of, you know, the elements of the meal. And I see these 1 and 2 year old children reaching out and begging for pieces of lettuce, you know, and it's like, okay, I know I'm in a vegetarian household when the kids are begging for pieces of lettuce. Because most people would not view lettuce as the most appetizing, delicious food. But it's actually kind of bland. But that was what was available to these kids in their environment. And so that became what they wanted. We tend to, of the food we have available to us, we tend to like certain things and not other things. And this actually tracks, to go into matters of science for a moment, this actually tracks with age. I don't know if you ever watched Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Cy, but
sometimes,
they have
yeah.
this, they, you know, the race, the Ferengi, the merchant race that has the ginormous ears. Well, you know, there's an episode of that where I think it's Quark, who's a Ferengi, is talking about Ferengi children. And he says, oh, you know, children, everything they pick up goes straight into their ears. Well, okay, that joke is based on the fact that human children tend to put things in their mouths.
Right, right.
You know, yeah. And puppies do the same thing. That's how they explore. That's why puppy biting exists, is because puppies are using their mouths as a tool to explore their world and get a sense of things. Well, humans do that too by sticking stuff in their mouths. And so very early, parents are often amazed at my kid will put anything in his mouth. And then after a few years, the kids become picky eaters, where there is a narrow range of foods that they will consume, and they don't want to try anything that falls out of their normal range. It's all chicken nuggets and hot dogs and pizza. Well, why is that? Well, the answer is when we're born, our bodies do not know what part of the world we're going to be living in, because humans can travel. You can be born in any part of the world, but you've got the same human biology. That means you don't know what the local food plants are when you're born. So you need, as you get weaned off milk, you need to be receptive to eating anything, whatever is available in the local area. But there are probably things in the local area that are bad to eat, that are poisonous or would cause, you know, gastric distress. And so you also need to be guided by your parents in what is safe to eat locally. And so what happens is kids are born with an initial openness to eating anything. And then as they learn from their parents what the local cuisine is, they become rigid and they don't want to eat anything that's not in the local cuisine because it might be dangerous. And so that's why they go from being super open to super picky as they mature. Well, so Jesus was born in the ancient Near East. Mary and Joseph would have brought certain foods to him that were common, and he would have had the same process that that other children do as they mature, and selected certain foods as his favorites. So that's the first factor, is food availability. The second factor is biology. Now, humans pretty much all like sweet things, because sweetness is a sign that it's filled with carbohydrates, and carbohydrates are a source of calories. Humans also like fat. Fats are flavor enhancers because they trap the aroma and taste particles in food and intensify it. That's why you add fat to a lot of recipes to make the food more flavorful. So certain basic things are programmed into us biologically. Incidentally, you know, cats, they don't have taste buds for sweet because they're obligate carnivores and meat is not sweet.
Oh.
So cats don't care at all about is something sweet. They can't even perceive it. But humans can. We can digest carbohydrates. We're omnivores rather than obligate carnivores. And so we can taste the sweetness to tell us this is a good source of carbohydrates. Now, there are more particular preferences, though, and presumably those are a matter of what I personally have habituated myself to. And it may be also, you know, the things I eat the most are the things I've habituated myself to. And so I tend to prefer those things because I'm used to them. But also, presumably, I have inbuilt biological preferences that vary from other people's because of my genetic code and the way my genes manifest. And so it's very likely that, and what allergies I have and things like that. Some food preferences, you know, like some people will say, I don't like that food because it upsets my stomach.
Yeah.
Well, right. I have that. A lot of root beers will upset my stomach. And so I like the taste of root beer, but it tends to upset my stomach. And so I tend to avoid it. And other people, you know, may not like a food because it upsets them or gives them hives, or it may affect them in a way they're not even consciously aware of, but it drives a preference. And that presumably was true of Jesus as well.
Seth, you brought us right to the end with that weird question. Only mildly weird question. Lots and lots of great weird questions. If you've got one you want to send it to us, you can send it to radio@catholic.com. We forward those on to Jimmy, or if you have another way of getting in touch with Jimmy, as many people do, because he's out there on the internets, go ahead and send it to him.
Just flag it as a weird question so I'll know what bucket to put it in.
All right. Yep. To say, hey, Jimmy, I got a weird question for you, and then give it to him. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, mysterious.fm. Jimmy, thanks. I really enjoyed these 2 hours.
My pleasure. Me too.
That does it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.